Hello there and welcome. Today is Friday, June 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Senate Republicans reveal their health care bill as Democrats cry foul.
So sad, Mr. President. Heartless. Mean and heartless.
Friends and family say farewell to the American student who died shortly after being released from North Korea.
It was beautiful to see the love and support that he got.
A look at how and why Russia is trying to influence Western elections. And also ahead, the rise of women in Hollywood. It's all on today's International Edition. Republicans in the U.S. Senate have unveiled their version of a health care bill aimed at repealing the Affordable Care Act, former President Barack Obama's signature legislative achievement. After weeks of secret meetings, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell released the proposal Thursday to lawmakers from his Republican Party before publishing the text online. Speaking from the floor of the Senate, McConnell said it was time to act.
I regret that our Democratic friends made clear early on that they did not want to work with us in a serious bipartisan way to address the Obamacare status quo. But Republicans believe we have a responsibility to act, and we are, for our constituents, for our state, and for our country.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, though, said the proposal was mean.
This is a bill designed to strip away health care benefits and protections from Americans who need it most in order to give a tax break to the folks who need it least.
Legislation was crafted as a compromise between the current health care law, commonly known as Obamacare, and a measure approved by the House of Representatives last month. Joining me now for analysis is health care attorney Harry Nelson. Thank you for being with us. So what's your overall view of this bill?
My first impression is that there was not a big surprise in this bill. We knew that the senators were going to come up with something that was slightly to the left of the House bill in terms of delaying the Medicaid rollback. It was a little bit of a surprise how deep the ultimate Medicaid rollback is. And it looks like all that really happened was a delay in time. Bill also seemed to be closer to the Affordable Care Act with regard to the way it treats middle income group that used to be that are part of the health insurance exchanges. So it was a little bit of a surprise that there was a deviation from some aspects of the House bill, like the age bracketing and going back to a sliding scale, you know, income model for giving subsidies to working class Americans.
So overall, what do you see this doing? Will it help people? Will it hurt people? What's your overall take on that?
My impression is that this is a bill that's not going to make anyone happy. It's much more of a compromise than we saw from the House. So it has some pieces that are clearly designed to win over moderate Republican senators, like the return to protecting pre-existing conditions. At the same time, it has throws some bones to more conservative states by allowing states to decide to do away with certain parts of the minimum essential benefits, like protection for mental health coverage. So my sense is that this is a bill that really makes no one happy. And sometimes that's a recipe for passing legislation. Maybe sometimes a good compromise is when nobody walks away completely happy. But I think this is one of those situations where too many people have misgivings about the total package. And I don't think that this bill is going to come to a vote. I might be wrong, but I suspect that there's too many senators who are really on the fence about how their constituencies are going to respond to this.
So you don't think not only is it not going to pass, but you don't even think they're going to be able to vote on it because they know they'll lose?
Yeah, the Republicans only have a 52-48 advantage. And we already know that Rand Paul regards this bill as too liberal. And so that we already were in a situation where the Republicans could only stand to lose one more vote. If they fell to 50-50, then Vice President Pence would come and break the tie in their favor. But we're seeing concerns expressed by Senator Murkowski up in Alaska, Senator Collins in Maine, and a whole host of Republicans in these swing states. So the bill was designed to give them political cover by pushing the Medicaid rollback, which is unpopular in many of the states, out 7 years. But it's with so many grumblings going on so many fronts, it seems that the safest course, all they need to do is really lose two more Republicans. And it looks like we're pretty close to that. So I'll be surprised if this vote passes. It won't be a shock, but I think it's less likely that it will actually get to a 50-50 situation where Vice President Pence could step in.
Former President Barack Obama put out a statement urging senators to put the people ahead of politics and to really take a hard look at this. He said it would hurt the poorest and most vulnerable and help the wealthiest and the insurance companies by giving them tax breaks. How close to accurate is that?
I think that's mostly true. It's fascinating. You know, this bill got a positive reception from the stock market when you look at hospital stocks because it put back a lot of Medicaid funding in the next few years. That the House bill was going to pull away Medicaid funding in 3 years, and this bill pushes it out 7 years. So investors liked that news. But if you look at the long term, the net effect in 7 years of the Medicaid cuts and shifting Medicaid to a capped spending model is going to hurt the poorest Americans. And this bill does have many of the tax cuts that that are only going to benefit wealthier Americans. So I would say the statement is true.
If it does pass the Senate, then it has to go back to the House again?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing is even if this bill gets by, squeaks by, it's really a good question of whether the House is going to compromise and shift leftward to get a bill on the president's desk. I think it's a good bet that this bill isn't going to get there in the first place. But even if it does, that's going to be a hurdle. This bill has gone significantly more liberal on things like pre-existing conditions, which is a $100 billion expense, and it has several other provisions that are really going to be hard for the House Republicans to swallow.
All right. Healthcare attorney Harry Nelson, thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A New York man is charged with trying to join IS. A Yazidi girl reunites with her family after Islamic State kidnapping. A female passenger wins a gender bias case against an Israeli airline. And a survey finds that Americans are divided over gun policy issues. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. An estimated 2,500 mourners gathered Thursday to remember Otto Warmbier, the American college student who died this week after being held for nearly a year and a half in a North Korean prison. In Warmbier's home state of Ohio, friends and family attended his funeral at his former high school.
It doesn't really feel real yet. He's so young, and it just, you know, he's been gone for so long with it, and the impact he made is always going to last with people, so it just doesn't feel real yet, honestly.
Warmbier was sentenced to hard labor in North Korea after attempting to steal a propaganda poster from a hotel in Pyongyang. The 22-year-old was medically evacuated to the United States last week with severe brain damage. Speaking at the funeral, Ohio Senator Rob Portman called Warmbier an amazing young man who should have never been detained.
North Korea needs to be held accountable for what happened to Otto Warmbier. They have shown not only do they not have regard for the rule of law, the Geneva Convention, the basic freedoms that we enjoy and so many other people around the world enjoy, but they've shown through their treatment of Otto disregard for basic human rights, for human dignity.
Meanwhile, a bill introduced late last month in Congress would ban tourist travel to North Korea. And the New York Times is reporting the Trump administration is under growing pressure to strike a deal to reduce the American footprint in South Korea in exchange for a freeze on Pyongyang's nuclear program. But Tufts University Korea analyst Sung Yoon Lee tells VOA's Victor Beatty, dialogue like that in Washington will not move China to change its current attitude toward North Korea.
Dialogue, consultations, conversation between the U.S. and China, that's a good thing, because at the very least, both sides can better assess and ascertain the other side's interests, intentions. There's intelligence value in discussing issues of mutual interest. Of course, dialogue in itself will not resolve deeply embedded important issues between the two countries. For example, approach to North Korea's nuclear weapons program, the South China Sea, and a host of other issues, including economic issues. The fact that the two sides met at a high level, that's a good thing. But to assume that this kind of consultation or conference diplomacy will lead to any breakthrough on these sensitive matters, that would be an illusion.
Secretary of State Tillerson said, "We repeated to China that they have a diplomatic responsibility to exert much greater economic and diplomatic pressure on the North Korean regime if they want to prevent further escalation in the region."
Every U.S. Secretary of State since the nuclear crisis, the North Korean nuclear quagmire, flared up now some 25 years ago, has approached China, has exhorted to his or her Chinese counterpart to do the right thing, to exert political economic pressure on North Korea, to rein the Kim regime in. All those exhortations have fallen pretty much on deaf ears. And I don't mean to denigrate, slander China or Chinese leaders or their interests. The fact of the matter is nation states, especially big countries, act in some ways like an individual. Unless there is a crisis on your hands, unless there's a hot potato right there, unless there's an imminent penalty, a court order, jail time, unless you're right in the middle of a crisis, you are unlikely to act on things that are not in your immediate interest. So China needs to be presented with some economic disincentives, some costs. Moral suasion in itself will get nowhere.
That's Tufts University Korea analyst Sung Yoon Lee. President Donald Trump is questioning why his predecessor, former President Barack Obama, didn't block Russia from meddling in last year's presidential election. In a Twitter comment on Thursday, Trump posed a question, quote, "By the way, if Russia was working so hard in the 2016 election, it all took place during the Obama administration, why didn't they stop them?" Former Homeland Security Chief Jay Johnson said at a House intelligence hearing Wednesday that the extent of Russian hacking went significantly beyond past Russian efforts.
We saw efforts to dump information into the public space for the purpose of influencing the ongoing political campaign.
Well, joining me now for more is Stratford Senior Eurasia Analyst and Russian Expert Lauren Goodrich. Thanks for being with us. So as Russia continues to influence more and more Western elections, what exactly is its motive here?
We've seen over the past, I would say, 3 years, Russia really switch over from conventional warfare, like we saw in 2008, to nonlinear or hybrid warfare, which includes disinformation, propaganda, and cyber campaigns, which have pretty much become Moscow's number one tool in the toolbox, which is very different than having your military as your number one tool in your toolbox. It's just getting much more bang for its buck on using, you know, these propaganda, disinformation, fake news, you know, cyber campaigns instead. And what it's trying to do, it's really multifaceted. Moscow is trying to gain, of course, support for more Russo-friendly political groups. But if it can't get more Russo-friendly groups, then it just wants to sow chaos and undermine the cohesion of Western institutions and states and Western unions together, and then overall just shape the view of Russia and its actions.
How does it do that?
We've seen quite a shift out of Russia in which Russia has vastly expanded. For 2017, its federal budgetary spending and what it calls communication abroad. And that section of the federal budget, which you can only see part of it, has likely quadrupled, if not gone 8 times over what they spent in 2016. So that's why we're just seeing the mass flood of information, because the communication abroad section of the budget actually funds Russian media efforts abroad, which include primary foreign media outlets like Sputnik and RT, as well as ones that are kind of more hidden and you don't really know if they're Russian or not, as well as the country's Agency for Internet Studies, which is better known as the Russian internet troll factory. And these troll factories have really popped up all across Russia. The one that is the most famous one that was infiltrated by a pro-Western journalist was the one right outside of St. Petersburg, in which it's 400 employees. And all they do is sit there and write blog entries and comments for news and spread fake stories via social media and really create its own jargon on trying to go against mainstream or pro-Western information that's going out there.
How much of an influence does Vladimir Putin have on these? Is he directing this?
We're seeing Putin's own personal security service called the National Guard decide in just recent months that it's going to create its own internet, quote unquote, security and communication center, meaning a troll factory. And so now we're starting to see him pop up underneath factions that are loyal to Putin and then some that may not always be loyal to Putin, which is going to be interesting moving into the future on whether there's going to be mixed messaging on how to shape the view of Russia and Putin himself moving forward.
Is it a good idea for the United States to try to be friends with Russia? Or would you say Russia, as John McCain has said, is a bigger threat than ISIS?
No matter who's in charge of the United States, Russia always has the strategic imperative to push back on U.S. influence. It doesn't matter how friendly the leadership of the United States is or is not. Russia doesn't change. Its imperatives don't change. Its strategy doesn't change. It wants to have dominance and influence over its periphery and really wants to kind of push back on the U.S.'s, you know, dominance worldwide and really kind of fracture that and also fracture the Western front. And so even if there was a more, you know, pro-Russian leader inside of Washington, Russia's not going to change its stripes. And there's nothing that will change Russia until it's time for a new regime to come in. It's always going to act this way. And so the United States should maintain its imperatives because Russia is going to maintain it.
We are starting to see pushback toward Russia, certainly with France's president and others. What kind of an impact will that have?
It was a very interesting meeting between Putin and Macron, in which he, in front of the media, called Russia's propaganda units, RT and Sputnik, deceitful propaganda. He just did not mince words, which really shows where the Western leaders' heads are starting to move to, instead of trying to, let's figure out, you know, just a way to deal with Russian propaganda. Let's start countering it. And over the last few years, we've really seen pretty much, you know, spurred by the Central Europeans and by the Baltics and Eastern Europeans, their desire to really create centers to counter propaganda and real legitimate centers that would cross borders, have multi-country platforms, would either be tied to the European Task Force Against Propaganda or the NATO Center for Countering Propaganda. And we're seeing a pretty quick expansion of these centers. The NATO one in particular, just today, Belgium and Sweden said they're going to join the Estonian Center, which makes 16 countries that have all come together that said they're going to work together to counter very, you know, targeting Russian propaganda. The Czech Republic has created a wonderful center in which they've hired a bunch of Russian speakers to counter Russian language fake news stories. And the EU has its own task force, but it just doesn't have enough funding or personnel to really get it up and running. But we are starting to see at least the attention grabbed by these Western leaders, particularly Germany, you know, Great Britain and France, to maybe jump onto that bandwagon that the Central Europeans and Eastern Europeans are already trying to push. And we could start to see a real united cooperative front on countering propaganda within the governments and not just from companies like Facebook or like Twitter, but to where it crosses from private sector to public sector to governmental, everyone kind of banding together against Russian strategy at this moment.
All right. Stratford senior Eurasia analyst and Russia expert Lauren Goodrich, thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong.
You love music?
How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we turn to what's trending on social media. Here's Andrew Palchewski.
Trending today, a new mission for Facebook and a new look at how we consume news online. First to Facebook. On Thursday at Facebook's first ever community summit, CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced a change to the social network's mission, saying that the new purpose of Facebook is to, quote, give people the power to build community and bring the world closer together. He continued, quote, for 10 years, we focused on doing everything around connecting people with their friends and family. Now I think that there's a whole lot of similar work to be done around communities, meeting new people, getting exposed to new perspectives, making it so that the communities that you join online can translate to the physical world too, end quote. Keep in mind that while Facebook has always been about finding and connecting with friends and family, the site has added the ability to connect in groups and communities organized around common ideas and interests. Zuckerberg's announcement suggests he wants to take that mission even further, bridging global divides and bringing the world closer together. And with more than 2 billion monthly active users, Zuckerberg is going to have a big chunk of the world's population to work with. And a new study is giving us perspective on how we consume online news. The Reuters Institute and the University of Oxford has released their 2017 Digital News Report, a survey of more than 70,000 online news consumers around the world that examines everything from how news organizations use social media to changing trends like paid content to the spread of fake news. So here are some of the big takeaways. Facebook was rated the most useful social network to find news content, with 19% of people calling it a useful source of news. 10% of respondents considered YouTube to be a useful news source, but just 6% said they found news on Twitter. Now, one potential explanation is that the survey was global, and Twitter isn't widely used around the world, or at least not as widely used as it is in the U.S. In the U.S., there's also been an increase in the past year in the number of people using social media to get news content. Worldwide, however, there's been actually a decline in the number of people getting their news on social media. You can find all of the data and findings from this year's report at www.digitalnewsreport.org.
All right, that's VOA's Andrew Palchewski. You can follow him on Twitter at apal. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, women have always been an essential component of Hollywood as lead actresses in the romance genre, in comedy, and even drama. But women have found it difficult to establish themselves in roles traditionally claimed by men in the film industry, such as filmmakers and leads for superhero films. But this summer, that ceiling has finally been broken by talented women. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
$500 million and counting. That's right, you heard it right. Wonder Woman, starring mesmerizing actress Gal Gadot and filmmaker Patty Jenkins, have broken the box office record for a female director.
I care about making the greatest Wonder Woman of all time because I love Wonder Woman and I'm a filmmaker. So nothing's ever going to make that more interesting to me. So the fact that I'm a woman or she's a woman or we're all women or whatever was a wonderful, deep part of it. But it also you just tune it out completely because I'm just a filmmaker trying to make a film that I care about that much anyway.
Jenkins's Wonder Woman is the best depiction of Princess Diana of Themyscira so far, because it combines impressive high action sequences with a great story arc about Wonder Woman's journey, leaving her utopian world to go to the war front during World War II to fight and defeat evil. Jenkins' superheroine model combines power and grace.
Being a hero is often not a proactive state of being of going and punching somebody out and therefore things being over. It ends up being so much more on an everyday scale about understanding and love and forgiveness and the complexity of life.
Next to this great woman is brave pilot Steve Trevor, interpreted by Chris Pine.
I am so lucky that Patty was the one to direct me. Her vision for Diana was in line with mine.
The dynamic duo of Gal Gadot and Patty Jenkins is more proof that Hollywood studios can entrust big budget productions to women. And they are not the only ones. Filmmaker Sofia Coppola recently received the coveted Palme d'Or for Best Director at Cannes Film Festival for her remake period drama, The Beguiled.
Amy! Help! What happened?
The original movie is right? From the male point of view, the soldier's point of view of this woman's world. And I thought it would be so interesting to go back and find the book and tell the same premise, but from the women characters' point of view.
The film offers poetic cinematography and an all-star female cast. Nicole Kidman and Kirsten Dunst play the lead roles as teachers in charge of an upper-class boarding school for women fending for themselves during the United States Civil War. Their orderly life is disrupted by a handsome, injured Union soldier seeking refuge at the school, sowing discord and jealousy among the women. Sofia Coppola is only the second woman to win Best Director at Cannes in 71 years, and though many would argue she has an advantage in the industry coming from the Coppola filmmaking dynasty, her talent is undeniable.
Still only 4% of women directed, I think, the major motion pictures of 2016.
Wonder Woman's box office triumph and The Beguiled's artistic recognition are opening the door for more female auteurs in mainstream Hollywood. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Oh, what have you done to me, you vengeful bitches!
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdulrahman. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump has signed a directive charting a new course in U.S. relations with Cuba. Citing the continuing repression of the Cuban people by the Castro regime, President Trump imposed new restrictions on U.S. travel to and business with Cuba, thereby reversing parts of an executive order by the Obama administration aimed at easing relations with the Cuban government. In a speech in Miami, Florida, announcing the shift in policy, President Trump declared that the previous administration's easing of restrictions on travel and trade does not help the Cuban people. They only enrich the Cuban regime.
The profits from investment and tourism flow directly to the military. The regime takes the money and owns the industry. The outcome of last administration's executive action has been only more repression and a move to crush the peaceful democratic movement.
The new U.S. policy channels economic activities away from the Cuban military while allowing American individuals and entities to develop economic ties to the private small business sector in Cuba. It makes clear that the primary obstacle to the Cuban people's prosperity and economic freedom is a stifling state-controlled economic system, including the Cuban military's extensive presence throughout the Cuban economy. The policy also enhances travel restrictions to better enforce the statutory ban on U.S. tourism to Cuba. Among other changes, travel for non-academic educational purposes will be limited to group travel. In addition, the new directive reaffirms the U.S. embargo on Cuba. President Trump declared, "We will not lift sanctions until all political prisoners are freed, freedoms of assembly and expression are respected, all political parties are legalized, and free and internationally supervised elections are scheduled." The United States Embassy will remain open, said President Trump, in the hope that our countries can forge a much stronger and better path. When Cuba is ready to take concrete steps, we will be ready, willing, and able to come to the table to negotiate that much better a deal for Cubans, for Americans. The United States, declared Mr. Trump, believes that free, independent, and sovereign nations are the best vehicle for human happiness. At the same time, he added, we all accept that all nations have the right to chart their own paths, so we will respect Cuban sovereignty. But we will never turn our backs on the Cuban people. That will not happen.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.